This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Welcome to Desert Island Discs, where every week I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, the book and the luxury item that they'd want to take with them if they were cast away on a desert island. For rights reasons, the music on these podcast versions is shorter than in the original broadcast. You can find over 2,000 more editions to listen to and download on the Desert Island Discs website. This is an extended edition of the original broadcast. My castaway this week is the musician Christine McVie. As an essential part of the supergroup Fleetwood Mac, the singing, songwriting and keyboard playing she contributed to their sound was era-defining. You Make Loving Fun, Oh Daddy, Little Lies, Everywhere and Songbird are a few of her most enduring compositions. But whilst Fleetwood Mac's output represents the ultimate in mid-70s melodic rock, their backstage behaviour was often less than harmonious, with breakups, booze, drugs and egos making life in the band, well, complex. Yet through it all, my castaway seemed to steer a relatively straight path, never entirely giving way to the worst excesses of the rock and roll playbook. Maybe it was something to do with her background. Her father was a concert violinist, her grandfather an organist at Westminster Abbey, and her maiden name is, I kid you not, Christine Perfect. She says of the glory years with Fleetwood Mac, the music was all we lived for. That was what tied us together. While everything else was falling apart, we were all living in this dream world, doing too many drugs and drinking too much, all busy getting divorced and fighting among ourselves. And therein lies quite a tale, Christine McVie. But usually I think musicians and artists tend to be, when I speak to them, most passionate about the things they're doing right now. And what you have been doing right now is touring. Tell me a bit about the music that you are currently making.
Well, I've just finished an album with Lindsay Buckingham, which has turned out to be a bizarre happening, because you may or may not know that I left Fleetwood Mac for 15 years.
Yeah.
And that happened for a number of reasons. Primarily, my father had been ill and I'd been living in America for 30 years. I decided I had to go back and see him. I was afraid of flying. And for multiple reasons, I just felt I wanted my roots back. And that meant, you know, I would have to leave the band. And I was ready. You know, I'd been living out of a suitcase for so many years. I hate suitcases to this day. And
so making music with Lindsay Buckingham, of course, legendarily part of Fleetwood Mac as well. What has that experience been like, the two of you making music together?
Fantastic. When I first rejoined Fleetwood Mac, I started to write again, which I hadn't done for many years. I barely even looked at a piano.
Really?
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know why, but that's the way it happened. But anyway, I started writing songs again and sending them over to Lindsay, who's my favourite guy to work with. And between the two of us, we compiled quite a few bits of material. And before the tour started, he said, why don't you come over a bit earlier and we'll try and put these down in the studio to reconnect, in other words, because we didn't know if we had any chemistry, because we hadn't seen each other for so long. And we both walked into the studio not knowing what was going to happen. And it was as though it was only yesterday when I had left the band. It was amazing.
I mentioned some of the enduring songs that you have written, among them You Make Loving Fun, Oh Daddy, Little Lies, Everywhere, but I'm going to fan-bomb you now. Songbird, which is one of my favourite.
Fan-bomb?
I'm going to throw the love at you. Songbird is one of my favourite, and I'm going to take absolute advantage of the fact that I've got you here to ask you how it was written. Such an immaculate and beautiful love song.
Well, that's a mystery to me as well, because all I know is that we were recording Rumours, and Stevie and I were sharing a condominium in Sausalito, and I'd gone to bed and I couldn't sleep, and I got this song in my head. And fortunately, I had a piano in my room, nothing to record it on, but I had to play this song. It was as if I'd been channeled or something. And this song came out.
The whole song?
The whole song, complete, chords, words, everything, within half an hour. This was at 3 o'clock in the morning and I couldn't go to sleep in case I forgot it. So I had to play it all night long. until I could get in the studio about 9 o'clock the next day, and I just had to get it on a two-track tape.
How do you explain that?
I can't explain it. I wish all songs could come that easy. I just felt as if it was a universal kind of prayer or something. I just don't know where it came from. It's never happened to me since or before.
Christine McVie, let's start with your first choice of the day. Tell me a little bit about this piece of music, specifically why you've chosen it.
Well, this always reminds me of my father, because my father, being a concert violinist, I always used to hear him practising in the front room, as we called it. And he was often playing Vivaldi.
That was the second movement of Vivaldi's Four Seasons Concerto No. 4 in F minor, Winter, with Nigel Kennedy on violin, accompanied there by the English Chamber Orchestra. You said to me, Christine McVie, during that it took you right back to watching your father play, and his beard would be going, and the whole sort of house would be reverberating with this music.
Yes, that you could virtually hear nothing else. It was just a wonderful thing. You could be in the kitchen cooking, or Mum would be cooking in the kitchen, and Dad would be playing away, and a few mistakes here and there. It was just a delight.
And so Dad was Cyril. He was a music lecturer. He made a living at as well as being a performer. You once described him as eccentric. Tell me more about that.
Well, he was a man, I think, that kind of lived above his means. Always I remember him in his evening suit with his dicky bow on, because he was forever going out to concerts. His beard and had long grey hair and his violin in hand. And he used to be gone a lot, but he was the one for going to the bar afterwards and having a couple of scotches with the chaps, you know.
Not uncommon among musicians.
Not uncommon, yes. But I mean...
And how did your mother feel about
that? Well, I don't think she liked it very much, because she didn't drink and, you know, he wouldn't get back till midnight or something. But he taught during the day, taught music at a teacher's training college.
And you played together as a family?
Christmas time we did, yeah. My mum used to attempt to play the viola. She was not musical, my mother. But my brother played second violin, my dad played first, I played cello. And somehow we managed to crawl through several Christmas carols and things. We mostly ended up laughing the whole time. It was good fun.
So your mother didn't drink. She wasn't particularly musically gifted.
No.
What was she like as a mother? When you conjure her up, what do you see?
Well, she was the most amazing mother. She was actually a psychic, very psychic woman, and actually was a healer.
Right. Tell me more about that.
Well, my experience, my memory of it, I was only aware of it once concerning myself, when I had a big wart under my nose right there. I still have a little scar, but it was huge and it came from nowhere. I think I was 11 or something like that. And my mum tucked me up in bed one night and put her finger on it. She said, "That'll be gone in the morning, dear." And it was. The next morning it was gone.
And did people come to the house to see her and to see
No. She kept that side of us. I mean, I wanted her to as well. She kept herself quite quiet about all that. That side of her kind of scared me when she went to her bedroom and shut the door and did whatever she did. And so that side of her life I really kind of didn't want to hear about, because I was growing up. I was 9, 10, 11 when I was aware of this side of my mum. But I just wanted her to be an ordinary mum. But she secretly had a group of friends that she would have seances with, and she belonged to the Psychic Society of Birmingham, I think. And she would go to seances, and she had a spirit guide, and she couldn't paint at all, but whilst she was in a trance, she drew a painting of her spirit guide, who was called Silver Shadow or something, Indian, with the headdress and everything. It was a profile of this American Indian.
What do you make of all that now?
I don't know. I get chills when I talk about it, actually. I don't know. Because my mum died actually quite young. She was 52 and she died of cancer. So she died really young, and it's such a pity.
Let's have some more of your music, Christine. We're going to listen to your second track. Just tell me a little bit about this and why it's on your list today.
Well, I used to study classical music growing up, and I was in there practising one day, and I looked in the piano stool, and there was a book of Fats Domino music, which belonged to my brother. And I hadn't seen it before, so I picked it up and started sight reading it. And this was one of the songs, and I think that's how I got interested, where my boogie left hand came from. And that's kind of stayed with me throughout all my songwriting years. Even when my songwriting style changed, there's always been a little bit of that boogie bass, so that's what this is all about.
You made me cry when you said goodbye. Is that a shame? My tears feel like rain. Ain't that a shame? You're the one to blame. You broke my heart when you said we'll part. Ain't that a shame?
That's Domino and Ain't That a Shame, and chosen by you, Christine McVie, because you said that was the moment when, if you will, the classical scales fell from your eyes. You found the bit of sheet music in the piano stool. You had been classically trained up until then as a musician.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy that process? Because for a lot of kids, it's pretty arduous and unpleasant.
Oh, it was arduous. I had a piano teacher up the road called Madame Amelia Hirons, and she was one of these really strict teachers that had the metronome on top of piano and the aspidistras in the windows. And she was really strict, and she had a ruler, and I actually hated it. Fortunately, my parents were very forgiving about that. They let me stop going to classical lessons, and I just started going my own way and started to play the blues.
When did you discover then that you could write songs?
Well, the first song I ever wrote was at home, and I think I was about 16. I played it to my mum and dad. It was called I'll Never Stop Loving You. I can remember it to this day.
Would you sing a bit of it?
Yeah, it's pretty plebby. And I can't remember all the lyrics. The rivers may run dry, da, 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 but I'll never, no, I'll never, stop loving you.
At 16, not bad.
The uh-huh is good.
I'm trying to think, I was trying to think of female singer-songwriters that you might have had as role models. I could only pathetically come up with one, Joni Mitchell, towards the sort of mid and end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s. Were there any women you were looking at and thinking, I'd like to do what she's doing? I'd like to do it my way, but I'd like to do what she's doing.
No, I don't think so. I was very reticent about writing. It was Mick that really encouraged me, because I didn't think I was any good. I made a solo album with a couple of songs I'd written myself, which I really had no confidence in whatever.
And you won Female Vocalist of the Year.
I did.
Twice, in fact, in 1969 and 1970. You were well regarded for your voice, but you didn't regard your voice
particularly. Not particularly, no. Yeah. I think because there weren't that many singers around at that time. There was Julie Driscoll and me.
The first ever band that you joined was, I think, Sounds of Blue. That might give us a clue. I mean, what sort of music were you making and playing?
Well, it was the blues, but we also, there was a flautist in the band called Chris Wood, who then went on to be in, I think it was Traffic, with Steve Winwood, who also became a friend of mine, all these guys from Birmingham, you know. So, yes, it was a blues band, but I played bass.
And what did your dad make of this?
They let me go. They really let me go. I mean, they really wanted me to teach because I went to Birmingham Art College and studied sculpture. But I was meant to have gone on and done a final year for a teaching diploma, and I knew I didn't want to teach. So I said, no, I'm going to leave now. I've got my national diploma in design. And then I thought, well, now what do? You can't go and get a job as a sculptress, can you? And I got a job as a window dresser in Regent Street. and I hated it.
I'm going to ask you about that in a second. For now, Christine McVie, let's have a little bit more of your music, and I want to hear your third track. Just tell me about this.
This is Roll Over Beethoven. My parents bought me the Beatles album for Christmas, and it was during Beatlemania, and I was one of the Beatlemaniacs. I must have been about 19, I guess, 20. I played this record until there was nothing left of it, over and over and over again, and I used to look at myself in the mirror, as every young girl did, holding a brush or something and singing along to the tracks and shaking my head. And
that sound that was so new and so fresh at the time, what impact did it have on you?
Well, I think that it was so sparse. I mean, there was barely any instrumentation. It was all about the melody, the songs, the harmonies. The voices were so up front and so crystal clear. And I think that their use of space in the music was crucial, and it just gave them, well, the songs held up for themselves, just brilliant, brilliant songs, one after the other. We're gonna write a little letter, gonna mail it to my local DJ. It's a rocking little record, I want my jockey to play. Roll over Beethoven, gotta hit it again today. You know my temperature's rising at the jukebox.
The Beatles performing the Chuck Berry classic Roll Over Beethoven. Christine McVie, you mentioned the job that you hated, and it was at Dickens and Jones, a West End store in London, around about 1966. What did they make you wear as a window dresser? What was your uniform?
Oh, it was dreadful. I mean, all the girls had to wear tapered worsted trousers with a zip at the side.
Nice.
And a grey cardigan.
Was London in 1966, yeah.
But it wasn't even cashmere. It was really itchy fabric, and it just drove me nuts.
You hated the job, and by 1967, you mentioned this band, Chicken Shack. By 1967, you had joined Chicken Shack, and you debuted in 68 at the Windsor Jazz Festival, up on stage, singing. How did that feel? Did you enjoy the limelight?
Well, I didn't know what on earth I was doing there, really. You know, this friend of mine from Sound of Blue was walking past the window of Dickens and Jones one day and saw me in the window and knocked on the window. So I went out to meet him on a coffee break, and he said, "You want to join a band? Moon's down and forming this group called the Chicken Shack. You know, we need a keyboard player." So I said, "But I can't really play the blues." He said, "Well, I'll give you lots of records. You can just, you know, have a listen." So that's what I did. I listened to tons and tons of blues records and stole a few licks here and there and got myself a little library of stuff to play. So that's when I joined Chicken Shack. And God knows, I had no idea where I was going. It was better than being a window dresser, though.
Tell me then about the time when you ran off the stage.
That was in Nottingham, I think. It was the solo tour I did.
What happened?
I don't know. I just knew that the solo thing wasn't for me. I couldn't sustain an entire performance, just me. I'm part of a group. I'm comfortable with two, like Lindsay and I, for example. And I'm very, very happy within the framework of Fleetwood Mac at the moment.
So. And so round about that time then, just looking back for a moment longer, elsewhere, Peter Green's forming Fleetwood Mac in its original incarnation, named after two of his fellow founding members, Mick Fleetwood and John McVie. How did you get to meet John?
Well, Fleetwood Mac and Chicken Shack were on the same circuit, the blues clubs and the halls above pubs and things, and Fleetwood Mac had a massive following. They were huge, and justifiably so, they were fantastic. And often Chicken Shack would open for them at certain shows. And so I met them all and knew them all quite well. And it was actually, I think it was Peter Green I had a bit of an eye on.
He was rather gorgeous.
He was rather gorgeous. But actually I started talking to John and I just fell head over heels about him.
And so you were sort of co-opted into the band to be part of the lineup?
Eventually. I mean, I was still in Chicken Shack. I then left Chicken Shack because otherwise John and I would never have seen each other, because we would have been meeting on the doorstep with suitcases going in opposite directions. So I left Chicken Shack and became a housewife And then it was then when Peter was given some tab of acid at a party in Germany, and he kind of never came back.
The labyrinthine comings and goings of the members of Fleetwood Mac and who was in and out of the band could make an entire series, and indeed has on occasion, I think, on other networks. I want to wind forward to 1974 when Fleetwood Mac went to America and decided that they were going to try to make their music and maybe even make their fortune there. It was in a Mexican restaurant in 3rd Street in Los Angeles when you first met Stevie Nicks, Lindsey Buckingham.
Yeah.
They'd had a relatively long-term romance together. Can you remember what your impressions were of them, meeting them for that first time in that little Mexican joint?
I remember vividly. It was fantastic. And I just saw the five of us sitting around the table and I just thought, this has to happen.
Did you?
Yeah. And Mick had already said to me that it was down to whether I got on with the girl.
Right.
Because I had always been the only girl in the band. And he said, well, if you don't like her, we're kind of screwed. Fortunately, when I met her, I immediately took to her. I just thought she was charming and funny. I just remember her sense of humour, which she still has to this day, and I adore her. Plus, Lindsey was the god. He was such a good-looking guy, still is. And then the chemistry flowed from there.
Let's have some more music, Christine McVie. We're going to listen to your fourth track of the day.
Yes, this is Peter Green. This is towards the end of his musical career with Fleetwood Mac. I think you can hear it's a quite reflective song on this live. It's a beautiful song. It really gives me a little tear in my eye, to be honest. This is just before he left. And one can only wonder what he would have written had he stayed, because he was just finding his feet in a different direction in music from the blues.
Shall I tell you about my life? They say I'm a man of the world. I've flown across every tide. I've seen lots of pretty girls. I guess I've got everything I need.
Fleetwood Mac, Man of the World. You seemed, Christine McVie, very deep in thought.
Yeah, it just makes me sad, really, to think what he could have been doing when you listen to how beautiful that song is.
And indeed was regarded as possibly one of the finest music makers and guitarists of his generation. But for now, you said it was quite brilliant. Your face lit up when you said, you know, I looked at the five of us sitting round that table in that Mexican diner and I just thought this has got to happen. When particularly the three of you, Stevie and Lindsey and you, were standing round the mics and making those exquisite harmonies together, what struck you?
Well, there's one particular time, the very first rehearsal in LA, and I'd written a song called Say You Love Me, which ended up being on the White Fleetwood Mac album, and I said, oh, it goes like this, and I came in with the chorus, and Stevie and Lindsey just chimed in with the perfect harmonies, first time through, and we all just got goosebumps. John McVie went, what? How can that possibly be? So it was a thrill. And that first album, the White album we made, I remember being the most fantastic time, more so than Rumours.
So Rumours, it came out in 77. You'd spent much of 1976 recording the album. It would go on to sell 40-odd million copies and counting, still being sold
successfully. It's still in the charts, yeah. Apparently. I mean, low, but it's still there. It's hovering around there.
So many songs on it that have gone on to become rock classics. Brilliant for those of us who have loved it. What was it like for you to listen to that music and to watch it connect with so many millions of people?
I mean, I think we were in a state of disbelief. I think we knew we got a great record. There was no question of that. But I think because of all the internal angst that we were all going through, I don't think we could really believe it. And it became quite normal for it to be number one.
And, of course, aside from this brilliant music, it was essentially the sort of back-to-back diary of two relationships falling apart. I mean, that's what the songs were about.
It was.
Take me back to that moment. How were you relating to each other?
Oh, there were little groups of us that got on really well.
So who did you get on with?
Well, I got on with everybody but John.
Your husband at the time, yes.
And Stevie got on with everybody but Lindsay. And Lindsay got on with everybody but Stevie. And Mick was in the middle going through a divorce of his own with Jenny Boyd. So there were groups of us that got on fine, but you got the wrong people in one room. That could be difficult, you know.
I mean, it's such a hackneyed old cliche, isn't it, that, you know, out of pain comes great art, but what do you make of it?
Well, if rumours is anything to go by, I think it has to be true. We need more angst.
What's remarkable is probably if we had talked to any band, certainly maybe around the same time, and I'm guessing even now, you know, there are all the interpersonal comings and goings. People have affairs within groups of people. They're touring together. There's a lot of booze around, sometimes a lot of drugs. That is the perfect alchemy for that sort of chaos. But what happens is everybody says, I'm chucking it, and they leave. Why did you stick with the band?
Well, I think it was because of the music, because of the art. I think we just knew that we had an alchemy.
Was it tense at the time, there and then? I mean, were...
In the studio?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, of course it was, yeah. And there was one control room, one studio and one lounge. And then, of course, there was all the hangers-on and there was a lot of drugs. Everybody was making hash brownies, and so it was all very psychedelic if you wanted to go that way. And somehow this music came out of, you know, we were talking about music having space. This record, when I listen to it today, has still got that kind of space when it's so cleverly produced. How it was done, I'll never know.
Christine McVie, now we're going to listen to some more of your music. This is your fifth. Tell me about this and why you've chosen it.
The Everly Brothers. Well, when I was at college, I was a huge Everly Brothers fan, me and my girlfriend, Teresa. And we started playing guitars and singing all the Everly Brothers songs. I was Phil and she was Don. And they came to play in the Birmingham Odeon. And Teresa and I skived off school and took our art pads and decided to set up and sketch the back door, the stage door of the Odeon. Such a stupid story. Anyway, it was freezing cold. Somehow we managed to get into the backstage and hide in a cupboard. Finally, I think they'd already been on stage and we were still in this cupboard. We decided we couldn't take it anymore. We got out and just mingled with a bunch of people. Nobody took a blind bit of notice of us. And there was Phil standing there, Phil Everly. And I had my sketchbook and he said, gee, can I see those? So I showed him my sketchbook and I said, could I have your autograph, please? So he gave me his autograph. And then years and years later, I met him when I was Christine McVie from Fleetwood Mac. And we did a duet together. And I told him that story and he remembered.
Don't want you.
The Everly Brothers and Kathy's Clown. Christine McVie, you have touched throughout our chat this morning on the years of excess, and I feel it deserves a good few questions all of its own, because it was quite a period, that time when Fleetwood Mac were the supergroup. They were touring the world. They were selling multi-millions in volumes of record sales. There were, how many limousines picked you up at the airport? There were like 14 limousines.
Not quite that many. There'd be one per band member. Right. So that's five, and then plus two or three trucks for luggage. Okay. Mainly mix luggage.
The money started rolling in. The excess was happening. What did you spend your cash on?
Well, one particular occasion I remember, we were rehearsing for the Tusk album. Because it takes a little while for the money to come creeping through. So we got some big whopping checks just around that time. And I just took it upon myself to call up my business manager and say, I want to buy a Rolls Royce today. And I want to drive it out of the showroom. So I did.
And was it enjoyable?
Yeah. The first half hour of it. Well, the first half hour was terrifying because I was afraid I was going to crash the thing. But no, I mean, it was just totally over the top. And I mean, I don't need a Rolls Royce, you know. I ended up getting rid of it and getting something smaller. But it was just the fact that I could.
And you say, well, rumours was being made, you know, there were hash brownies around, a lot of drug taking, and that you produced this exquisite piece of music and went on to do more. People, of course, get very exercised about that. They say this is a very, you know, we shouldn't talk about these things positively because, of course, drugs wreak havoc and misery and destruction through
Absolutely.
People's lives.
Absolutely.
Why? Well, not why, but do you think that they had something to do with the brilliance of the music you were producing? Do you think you needed that to make that music?
Well, that's something that we're never really going to know.
What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are that I don't know if I would have written Songbird had I not had a couple of toots of cocaine and a half a bottle of champagne and I just couldn't sleep. Or written any of the songs that were on that album. Because, I mean, I think we were all pretty loaded.
And again, I ask you, how come in those circumstances the whole thing didn't fall to bits? I mean, at one point you did this 18-month world tour in 1979 after Tusk. You were in Germany, you shared the bill with Bob Marley, you walked out in front of 250,000 people, I imagine every single one of them, delighted to see you. How does one hold it together to go out and perform and do it every night after night after night when all that is going on backstage?
I think you get the adrenaline from the audience because the adrenaline is so amazing that they give you the energy and the adrenaline rush and the kick and you give it back and they make the whole reason for performing live complete.
At its wildest, how did it get for you, all of that crazy life?
For me, well, I think I was probably the most restrained of the lot. I mean, I did have lots of days of staying away from it all and getting to bed early and being fairly sensible, but I was no angel.
And what is very interesting about you as a group is you all look fantastic. How come? Because you should look, I mean, by rights, you should be a bunch of shambling wrecks.
I don't have the answer for that. It's very true. Everybody does look great.
And all clean and serene now?
Clean and sober and happy and, yeah.
You made it
through. And healthy.
Yeah.
Somehow, we crawled through the cracks. All five of us all healthy.
Amazing. Speaking of which, just tell me about your sixth choice.
Yes. Dear old Dennis, who was a boyfriend of mine.
Dennis Wilson
from the Beach Boys. Yes, he's one that didn't get through the cracks, sadly. He was a mess. But he was charismatic and charming and really handsome. And he swept me off my feet big time. And we had a very, very roller coaster affair for a couple of years. I just adored him. He was bats, but it was the drugs. Anyway, this song I think Carl Wilson wrote this, but he wanted Dennis to sing it. He's got a very husky voice. I don't think Dennis is acclaimed enough. He was quite a talented guy.
Now the puzzle's laid out on my table. Pieces don't fit. I move from chair to chair. But that empty one's there. Sitting here going out of my mind, 'cause she's gone away. She couldn't wait, now I'm afraid it's too late. I'm waiting till my angel comes home.
With Dennis Wilson, your one-time love on vocals there. That was The Beach Boys and Angel Come Home. Tell me, Christine McVie, about this. It sounds, well, fascinating for my purposes, this period in your life when you entirely withdrew. You'd been living in California with the cream Rolls Royces and the hot and cold running Dom Perignon, whatever else, and you decided that this isn't for me anymore. I'm going to sell up. I'm going to buy an old sort of broken-down manor, Jacobean manor house in Kent, I think it was.
Yeah.
I'm going to give it all up. What did you think your life was going to become?
I think I had the some kind of wild image in my mind that I was going to become a country lady. Complete antithesis of somebody in the rock and roll world.
So why did you want that?
I think I wanted to settle. I wanted a nest. I wanted to be back in England again. I wanted to tread on English soil. Everything had to be really English. The Aga, the Range Rover, the hunter boots, the barber jacket, even the horsey scarf.
And did you take part in country pursuits?
No, no, no. I never so much as saw a horse, let alone get on the back of one.
People must have said to you, don't go, or you won't like it, or what on earth are you talking about?
Yeah, they did. I mean, every single band member, individually and collectively, tried to dissuade me from leaving. But I think because my dad was ill to start with and then had died, I wanted to be close to the rest of my family. My brother lives in Kent, and that's why I moved to Kent.
Could you just sort of take on a different persona, or did people bother you? Did they say, can you sign this for me? I've got rumours in the local sort of corner shop.
No, I didn't really, nobody paid much attention to me. It was quite amazing. A few people that obviously knew who I was, but nobody bothered me. And I was miles away from any homes, I mean, except for the local village.
And honestly, was there a bit of you that was bothered by that? That people didn't think, it's Christine McVie.
What, you mean that I was outraged?
Maybe not outraged, but...
How come nobody knows who I am around here?
You know, you have your ego fed for all these years.
Yeah.
And then it isn't. Is that fine?
Well, I kind of liked it for a while. I mean, I must admit, when I did leave the band, I left it 100%. I think I left my ego behind as well.
Did you?
To a degree, yeah. Because I just led a completely different life.
And you were married for the second time by then. Did you want a family life? Was that part of the idea?
No, I don't think, not as far as children go, no. I think I got well past the age and I'd never wanted children anyway. But that marriage was on the point of breaking up. Long story short, we got divorced and I ended up in that big house on my own.
And did you, I mean, where was music in your world at that point? Were you playing?
No, there was a beautiful piano there in the study, never played it.
This is peculiar.
Yes, it's odd. It's like the blank canvas again, the perfectionist in me. Every time I sat down to play the piano, I wanted to write Songbird again. So I was afraid to sit down and try, even.
In the meantime, Fleetwood Mac continued to make music. They continued to tour. And the point came in, I think it was 2009, when you went to watch them. What were your feelings at that point?
I thought they were great. I thought they sounded fantastic.
Did you think they were missing something?
I didn't. It was an interesting set for me because they put all kinds of songs in that they wouldn't have done had I been in the band. But there was always that empty spot where I would have been. They never filled that up. It was always left empty.
And so you went backstage, presumably afterwards, and they said what?
Oh, they were all thrilled to see me. I mean, Stevie was always bending my arm, trying to get me to come back, you know. But I, at that point, was not ready. People used to say, are you ever going to go back to Fleetwood Mac? And I go, I'd rather lick the bottom of my car or something like that, something crass, you know. But I can't tell you how happy I am that I changed my mind about that.
It was 2013 then, I think, when you changed your mind. At the beginning today when we were talking, you said, you know, I developed a chronic fear of flying and I had other issues. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, issues of isolation and... I developed agoraphobia,
right.
Dreadful fear of leaving my front doorstep. I mean, I couldn't even get in my car. That's how bad it was. And so then this therapist said, well, first of all, you have to get someone to drive your car out of the garage so it's close to the house.
Right.
So that happened. He said, now go and touch the car, have a look inside it, then the next day sit in the driver's seat. And I did that for about 2 weeks, and within 2 weeks I was driving again.
How extraordinary.
Everything started to move for me then. The stars were aligned, I'm sure.
Tell me about your next piece of music then. What are we going to hear, your seventh?
This is Lark Ascending, Vaughan Williams. It harkens back to my father again. But also, when I first heard this piece of music, I collapsed in tears with emotion. I just thought it was probably the most beautiful piece of music I ever heard. And also, interestingly, Peter Green was very influenced by this piece of music. it harkens to some of elements of what Peter's playing in his guitar playing when he plays Albatross and other such pieces of music. And I just love this. It's like a prayer.
That was part of Vaughan Williams' Lark Ascending, and the soloist there was Tasman Little with the BBC Symphony Orchestra conducted by Andrew Davis. Christine McVie, would it be fair to say that the most enduring relationship of your life has been with Fleetwood Mac and its band members? It seems to me that that has been, above all else, the thing that you have sustained.
Well, it has been. I was married to one of them for 7 years, and John and I somehow came out of all that chaos and are now really good friends. We're like brother and sister. Mick, I was always in touch with Mick, and he said, come on, Chris, you've got to get on a plane, come out, see me, you know. So it took me a while to do it, but I did it. And yes, they have sustained me for 45 years and longer, because I was there before Stevie and Lindsay joined.
You're going to embark on a tour in 2018 with Fleetwood Mac, a world tour. Up on stage again, and of course with, as you say, Stevie Nicks, Mick Fleetwood, John McVie, Lindsay Buckingham. Describe, can you, playing on stage with people that you have so much both musical and personal history with, what is that like when you step out with them?
Well, it's a great feeling of belonging, something that I felt so strongly about when I came back after 15 years of not playing music. When I rediscovered my love for that, and I trod on the stage for the rehearsal, besides rehearsing, and it was so familiar to me. And I felt as if all those years melted away. And I have this great feeling of huge respect and love for these. It's my musical family, and I adore every single one of them. And combined, we just create something. Even we feel it on stage, and I can't imagine what it must be like to be in the audience if you're a Fleetwood Mac fan, because it feels so great for us.
And tell me about your ego then, because I get, in spite of all this extraordinary success, I get a sense of somebody who seems rather to have their feet planted on the ground.
I mean, I suppose it would make me cross if my instruments weren't working. Things on stage, you know, professionally, that ought not to happen. Microphones falling off, things like that. I'm really not... I suppose maybe I don't have as big an ego as I think I do. But I'm aware of who I am, whereas I don't think I did before. I'm aware of...
Your status.
My status in the band now. It's secured because, you know, they've said to me, you've got to commit. If you want to come back, you've got to commit. So I said, I do commit. So I can't leave. I promised I won't.
And you are one of the very first women to have ploughed your own furrow in the way that you decided to make your rock and roll career. No, I will not be forced to be the front woman. I am contributing great, big, hefty hits. I'm in no sense second place. How do you look upon yourself as a, I think I can fairly say, a role model?
You've got to love it. I say go for the love of the music, not for wanting to be famous for being famous' sake. You've got to go and do your tenure, get out on the road, work, play live.
Given that you had that period of isolation and withdrawal from the world, the idea of plonking you on a desert island seems unbearably cruel now. How do you think you would...
I think it's hateful of you.
I do too. How would you get on, do you think?
Well, Funny enough, I have been on desert islands, albeit with a lodge and banders and things, and I should imagine it would be quite a challenge to not have anything at all. How long would I be on the island?
Indefinitely.
Oh, forever.
Possibly.
Really forever.
Possibly.
Well, I'd better choose a good book, hadn't I?
We're coming to that. For now, just tell me about your eighth choice of music. What's this?
It was suggested that I record this by Mike Vernon, who was our music producer at the time with Chicken Shack. And I thought it was a great song, and I thought, I don't know if I can really sing this, though. And, of course, he talked me through it, and I managed to sing it, and unbelievably to me, it went into the charts. And this kind of heralds the beginning of my career, really.
That was Etta James singing I'd Rather Go Blind. It's time now, Christine, for me to do what I do with all the castaways. I give them some books. The Bible you will get and the complete works of Shakespeare, and you get to take another book along with them. I wonder what yours is going to be.
I have a great fascination for Henry VIII.
Right.
So I was going to say the largest, biggest, fattest book that I could possibly have of the life and times of Henry VIII, including the social history.
OK, we'll find that for you. A luxury too, something that would just make life a little bit more livable on this island.
For me, it's obvious. It would have to be a piano.
Right. Any particular piano?
My Songbird piano, which is the one I used to take on the road with me. Just happens to have a beautiful sound. It's a baby grand.
OK.
I don't know what happens when it goes out of tune, though.
That's your problem to fix, I'm afraid.
Well, I'd have plenty of time to
do. Not giving you
that.
A tune or two. If you had to save just one track from the eight that you've chosen, which one track would you save from the waves?
I think, oh my goodness gracious me, I think it would... it's a toss-up between Man of the World and Vaughan Williams. OK, Vaughan Williams.
It's yours. Christine McVie, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Christine McVie, and you'll find over 2,000 other programmes to listen to at bbc.co.uk/Desert Island Discs, including editions with Annie Lennox, George Michael, Joan Armour Trading, Elvis Costello and Ed Sheeran. And I have a favour to ask. If you could rate and review the programmes wherever you download your podcasts, it'll really help other people find us. Thanks for listening.
This is the BBC.